Welcome to episode 465 of That Triathlon Show, the podcast presented by scientifictriathlon.com. My name is Michael Eriksson, and today I interview John Wakefield. John is a cycling coach and bike fitter. He's working with World Tour cycling team Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe. And with his expertise in both coaching and bike fitting, we of course cover both of these topics in depth in this interview. And I think you'll get some really great insights on both of these topics from this interview with John. But before we get into it, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel Hydration. They create carbohydrate products like gels, drink mix, and chews that are effective, practical, and tasty. And they create electrolyte products in different strengths, so you can choose one that best matches your sweat sodium concentration. In the interview, you'll hear us discuss the importance of fueling your work, and Precision Fuel Hydration's products make it really easy to do so because they're just really tasty without being overwhelming. So it's quite easy to keep consuming them even in longer workouts without getting palate fatigue. And the other thing that is maybe a bit more race specific, but when you're in a race, if you have gels that are 22 grams of carbs, it becomes a lot harder to keep track of how much you've eaten. And I guess that goes for training as well. But I just think that the Precision Fuel Hydration products that are always multiples of 30 grams, that makes it super easy to keep track of how much carbohydrates you're consuming and achieve your carbohydrate needs for any given workout or race. As a TTS listener, you can get 15% off your first order of 2025 by using the code TTS25 on precisionfuelandhydration.com. Now, without any further ado, let's get into the interview with John Wakefield. Welcome to That Triathlon Show, John. How are you doing?
You're well and yourself.
Very good, thank you. Please start with introducing yourself for the listeners. Probably a lot of them are familiar with you, but for those who are not, can you tell us a bit more about yourself and your background in cycling and endurance?
Sure. Yeah, John Wakefield from Cape Town in South Africa. Born and bred there. I currently obviously live in Europe at the moment. Yeah, I don't come from like your conventional cycling as a kid, went pro and ended up being a coach or whatever in that sort of environment. I got into cycling a little bit by accident. I crashed my motocross bike and the rehabilitation I did involved a bicycle, which I really enjoyed. Raced bikes locally as you do in Cape Town or South Africa. And then, I went from motocross coaching, met someone who's our business partner now, Dr. Jeroen Swart, and I got into cycling coaching. And that was probably 2007, I think, maybe 8. And I landed up where I am today. So a little bit by accident, but here I am.
How old were you when you had that crash and got into cycling through the rehab program?
That was 2001 I crashed. So I'll give away my age now, but that was, how was I? Like probably early 20s is when I crashed. Yeah.
And just a couple of questions about your current role before we get into some more general training and sciencey stuff. So first of all, if you have such a thing as a typical day or maybe a typical week in your work, what does that look like for you at the moment?
Yeah, it's different every day, although the theme is kind of, essentially all the same as based around performance. But yeah, kind of morning wake up, field a bunch of emails that had come from the day before. I then log on to Training Peaks or, whatever performance platform software system. I go over athletes, go over personal athletes, then obviously go over the team's athletes. If there's anything there that I see, I kind of handle it accordingly. Then I typically make contact with athletes. So by the time they're waking up, I've done that. And then the day consists of either I'm at a race, possibly I'm at a training camp, analyzing data, looking at data, scouting riders with the help of one of our scouts, biomechanic stuff, testing stuff. Yeah, it really varies from day to day, but it's quite vast and different every day, which keeps it interesting. So it's not sort of that same thing every single day, but kind of all within that performance field. And then kind of the day typically starts probably hop a 6 a.m. and it ends, if I'm at home, probably around about 9:00. If you had a race, it ends kind of whenever the day ends, midnight sometimes earlier.
Yeah, it's a lot of work. You work with, we might not have mentioned that actually, but you work with Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe, and I believe that your mostly involved with the under 23 squad. Is that correct? Or a younger generation squad?
Yeah, correct. So I moved from UAE Team Emirates at the end of the 2022 season, to which was then Bora Hansgrohe, into their performance department as a coach. With the collaboration with Red Bull, they have a strong focus on development and trying to find and identify talent. And if we call it the rookie project, was then, you know, part of that project. And they had asked me to kind of take over the directorship and build that rookie project. So while I have a large volume in that rookie environment, or that under 19, under 23 environment, I still have a strong connection to the World Tour team. My coach still coach a few handful of athletes there. And obviously that integration between World Tour and rookies is super important. So yeah, I kind of put on a couple of hats during the day.
And you mentioned your business partner, Jerome. So I think at least in the past years, you have worked through that business with age group athletes as well, in a coaching and bike fitting capacity. Is that something you still do, or is most of your time taken up by the work with Red Bull Bora Hansgrohe?
Yeah, a lot of my time is Red Bull Bora. And the reason for that is that we're lucky to have really good staff and other directors that put a lot of time and effort in. I do still do a lot of work with the company, obviously on a much smaller scale, just due to people that we have kind of managing and running the daily stuff. But I do still like being involved in projects. It obviously educates me at the same time. We do stay at the forefront of a lot of scientific stuff. You know, we as a company, we do a lot of research, whether it's biomechanics, whether it's testing, etc. So we do kind of pride ourselves on staying on the forefront of stuff. And then that, obviously, you can take that information and apply it to athletes. So it's a good thing.
Is that field research, or is it actually academic research that you publish?
Both, actually.
Okay.
Yeah.
And yeah, what are some things that in this role that you have now, and also in previous role, bigger roles, at least a place like UAE Team Emirates, is there something you can think about each of these roles and maybe other important roles that you've had in the past that you've learned from these different experiences and that comes to mind?
I've definitely learned to think before I open my mouth. I can definitely say that's the one thing I've learned. But yeah, I think the one thing that I've learned, you know, especially if I just take it as a cycling environment or a performance environment, is that, especially in today's terms, that it's an always changing environment. So, you know, which I said to someone today, actually earlier, if I coached today how I coached 6 years ago, it would be incorrect coaching. You know, not to say what I do is always 100%, but, you know, how cycling has changed over the last 5 to 6 years, you can't coach the same way, you know, so you need to evolve with that and kind of have your finger on the pulse. And the other thing I've learned very much so from a performance factor is that the line between, you know, success and failure is very linear, you know, and with attention to detail and stuff is really where you need to go now.
Linear as in, do you mean it's a very thin margin? Like,
yeah, it's a super, super thin margin, you know. Okay. And that's what I found, definitely more so than what it was. Again, if I use that sort of 6 year process, it's definitely a very linear line between success and failure.
So what is, at a very high level, something that you and probably others would have done in training 6 years ago that was working well then, but that wouldn't result in success today based on how cycling has changed?
I would more say from a monitoring side, on how you monitor an athlete and their well-being versus specifically a training model, you know, whether it's a threshold model or a, you know, 80-20 model, etc. I think now, in terms of how stressful and how intense and how big the loads are of today's racing, your recovery is key, and how you monitor the recovery to allow adaptation and progression, I think, is very important in today's times.
So let's segue into training then. That's a good place to end that career discussion. And starting with at a pretty high level again, what would you say are your core training principles?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would probably say consistency over time. You know, results essentially come from structure and execution. Adaptation tracking, you know, training, you know, really only works if you drive adaptation and not fatigue. Individualization, I would say, is definitely another one of them. You need to train the athlete, you know, for that, for the context, for the profile of the athlete, and for that athlete's physiology. And then also really kind of now, the older an athlete gets or more professional, is more kind of, you know, on their specificity. So prepare for what racing they're doing, whether that is energetically or mechanically. I think that is really important. And then I think a really big thing for me is to keep it simple. Don't overcomplicate things. You know, have a reason for a session. Don't try, you know, just don't overcomplicate things. I think people forget that the basics always win.
Yeah, I think those are great principles. To follow up on adaptation tracking, what are some methods that you use to do that?
I personally use the submaximal fatigue test. For me, if the rider answers the you know, subjective questions correctly, I think it's almost bulletproof. You know, it comes from Lambert's submaximal fatigue test. As a company, we took the base of it and we just sort of, again, kind of made it a bit more specific for what we're looking at for in modern cycling. So from that side, I use that personally. Obviously, other things that you can definitely monitor is, you know, HRV, weight, sleep data, subjective check-ins, you know, all the way up to, you know, training load, blood markers, even an athlete's mood.
Lambert's submaximal fatigue test we have covered before. I have interviewed Professor Lambert in the past, so I'll link to that. What your adaptations to the test, is that something that have you written about it on the blog that I know you have on your website, or so is that something that people can find online?
It's on our website, and we are actually in process of doing a publication on it. We are a little bit away from it at the moment from a date perspective, but it is going to be published.
Okay. Yeah. I'll try to find that blog post and put it in the link in the show notes as well. Then, that's actually my next question is so you can use the submaximal test to measure adaptation. Just, I guess, at a high level for listeners, we have talked about this on previous episodes, but if you have power, you have heart rate or lactate, and you have RPE, then you can get a good idea of adaptation there. If, let's say, your heart rate goes down for a fixed power and your RPE goes down, that's a positive sign, right?
Correct.
If your heart rate goes down and your RPE goes up for a fixed power, then that's a negative sign. But other than the actual measuring effect, what are some things that you think are important for creating that adaptation in the first place? What are the key things to pay attention to in training to set yourself up to adapt to training, not just do the training and tick it off?
Yeah, sure. I think, you know, your biggest, I would say, kind of marker for adaptation is recovery. For me, I think that's really important. A lot of the times you often see athletes doing too much, and then kind of when there's a negative trend, they think they're losing fitness or they're not fit enough, and they go harder or longer, you know. So from that side, I think, you know, recovery is probably the most single important part of it in terms of how you adapt to a training load. And then kind of markers around that is, like, obviously sleep is key, is king. Prioritize sleep quality, quantity, how regular you sleep. Other parts for that recovery and adaptation would be, you know, make sure that your nutrition is right. Monitor stuff, going back to it, like, how motivated are you? How fresh are you? Your RPE, session RPE versus expected RPE. And also another thing I think that is really important is your repeatability of key efforts or key sessions. I think that's kind of some really good points to follow.
What does mean, repeatability of key efforts? Is that week to week you're able to reproduce a similar performance in a similar session, or?
Yeah, so say you have a key session. So as an example, if we take it super simple, a 3x10, you know, everybody knows 3x10. And, you know, if you can do those repeatedly, or if we're seeing progress in them, you know, in training, and the continuous, as I said, repeatability of it. I think that that's a very good key marker of progression.
Yeah. Yeah, with the recovery, I think, especially now from the perspective, not so much of the World Tour riders, but a regular amateur endurance athlete, how do you square the willingness and the desire of athletes to push themselves to be better and to train hard and to fit in the training around work and family, but with also needing to recover enough to actually adapt to that? Do you have rules of thumb for how to think about, you know, how much training you're doing as an amateur athlete, especially so that you can actually still recover from the training?
Yeah. So where a professional has sort of a luxury in terms of recovery is that, you know, them going to work is to ride their bike and then they get home. Yes, you always have administration stuff to do at home, but essentially their recovery is a lot easier than what a guy with two kids has got. You know, typically their training time is limited. They need to drop their kids off at school. They need to go to work. They have a stressful day at work. You know, so then they come home and their wife shouts at them or their mistress or whatever the case may be, you know. So in terms of that recovery time, it's definitely affected, you know. So from there, it's almost more important for an amateur athlete to make sure that, you know, that recovery process and also that balance of training is really key. You know, so there, like you say, get your quality over quantity. Don't just always do more, more, and more. You know, stuff like, you know, fuel your training, do your endurance days correctly, etc. You know, don't kind of ruin your fueling habits. Don't try replicate the volume, the time availability. You know, they also don't have the support system like, you know, Sonia's massage, etc. You know, when it comes to an amateur. So for there's you need to control your outside stresses that have a direct effect on your recovery. And if you don't recover, you don't adapt as quick.
Yeah. And how much do you think, is there a genetic or life, I'm sure there is, but how big do you think the genetic effect of, or the genetic factor is in terms of how well athletes can do training, like assimilate training load and actually adapt to it? What I mean is the reason that pro athletes are professional athletes, one of the reasons anyway is that not just do they have superior VO2 max and all sorts of other physiological markers, but they also have a genetic propensity for doing the training and adapting to the training that maybe us mortals don't have. So it's not even just the time and the outside stressors, but just a genetic factor of not being able to do as much training even in the same situation. If that question makes sense.
Just repeat that for me again. It made sense and then it got lost. Sorry about that.
Basically, if I can leave everything and live like a pro cyclist for a year, but I have an amateur's genetics and not a pro cyclist's genetics, can I do this? Am I always going to be limited by the amount of training load that I can actually adapt to just by the genetics, not just by the outside factors? And even setting aside things like I'm doing everything at a lower level, you know?
Yeah, it's a good question. I would say yes, definitely. You know, from that side, you are limited. You know, you may definitely get better. You may handle a bigger load, you know, whatever. You have improved efficiency, mitochondrial density, whatever. You know, you may find 5%, 10%, 3%, whatever that level is. But at the end of the day, you can as you can always improve it, but you can always only handle so much volume, you know, and stress. And where that line is that, you know, you say, okay, great, you do a full year, or say we do 2 years and you live like a complete pro. Unless you really have a special genetic in you, you're not going to go world tour. You know, that's kind of unfortunately what the facts are.
Yeah.
And, no, I could, as an example, I could live like an absolute monk and be a complete professional triathlete. I'm still not going to go to Kona and win my age group. I can promise you that, you know. So from that side, it's definitely, I'd say yes, that there is definitely a limiting factor if we say that.
Yeah. And within the training then, if we focus in on the training aspect, how do you think about volume and intensity within the training? How do you balance the two?
Yeah, both are really important. You know, one needs the other one. You know, if we split it up, so volume, as I just sort of mentioned, you know, volume builds, as we know, it builds base. All the research shows volume is good. You have mitochondrial density, capillarization improves efficiency, durability, etc. And then obviously you need the intensity, you know, you need that for your adaptation of threshold and above. However, that, you know, balance of where it is really depends on time of the season, athlete type, what your goals are, your recovery capacity as an athlete, you know, and what your historical load tolerance is. But both of them are really important at specific times of the year.
In general terms, World Tour cyclists, how much intensity or how much volume do they do, and how much intensity do they do within that training?
Again, really depends on where that athlete is in the season. But I suppose if you take a number of an average, you'd be probably looking at about 20 hours a week on average, 18 to 20. Throughout the season, obviously some weeks you obviously do more. In terms of balance, that intensity, you'd probably be looking at 2, maybe 3 sessions a week.
Yeah. And what type of intensity would be done at different points of the season? What types of intensity are preferred in the, you know, winter base building blocks versus when you're approaching spring classic versus grand tours?
Yeah, so anything, sure. Yeah, it's a wide range. You would say everything, but, you know, if I take myself personally, so I can't speak for other coaches, but my off season, I enjoy volume, neuromuscular work and metabolic work. You know, so from that, you need the volume, so you need the base, but also I like to build neuromuscular pathways, force production and pedal economy, and help start building your durability on an athlete. And then also trying to create mitochondrial density, type 1 muscle fibers, increase some blood volume, etc. And that's sort of what I base a lot of my off season on.
Also, what type of training that looks like in practical terms?
So like torque work, so your low cadence work, and then sort of like a intermediate around fat max intensity as the other one.
Yeah, and then further into the season, spring classics.
Like the spring classics and that and the cobble classics, I still enjoy prescribing low cadence work because you do need it short hard climbs. You need that kind of pedal force on the cobbles, etc. But a lot of it is obviously then you start moving more into that that sort of higher intensity.
Yeah. And Grand Tour, finally, Grand Tour season. Well, how does, and obviously there are differences between the rider types as well, we should say, but.
Yeah, the Grand Tour, you just hope that you make 21 days. Eh?
Yeah.
That's it. Simple as that. Yeah, it's really different because you have your winner, you have a guy that's a super domestique on the mountains, you have a guy that's on the flats. If you're going with a sprinter, it's different, you know. So there, it's really super individualization.
Let's take a super domestique. That could be quite interesting. So not your team leader, but somebody who needs to be available to help the team leader at the key moments, key selections.
They need to be able to put out prolonged efforts. So, strong motor and a big base because they've got to put their nose in the wind all day. So,
like a lot of threshold tempo work,
Yeah, that I can't answer because then we start going into a bit more personalization on stuff. So I can't really answer.
That's fine. Coming back to the torque training, can you explain a bit more about how you structure that or how you think that, is that also something that amateur cyclists should consider? And yeah, a little bit more around that, discuss freely your thoughts on that and how to apply it.
It's for anyone, you know, it's whether you're an amateur or a pro, it fits into your training schedule. I would say that really well, adds a lot of benefit to it. You know, obviously with an amateur rider, you just want to be a bit more focused on the guidance side of it. if you haven't done it before, you know, and kind of the durations I like to prescribe is typically either 4 or 10 minutes. And that obviously, you know, based on if you want to go on a cadence, it's anything from a well-trained athlete that's done it before, they can do, you know, in and around 40 RPM. And if someone's untrained and has just started it, you'd be looking at sort of like, you know, around 60, 65. And then the more accustomed you get, you can lower it.
Yeah, yeah. Do you recommend doing this outside on a hill? Because I'm thinking at least with 40, when you go as low as 40, that becomes quite difficult on the trainer, because either you don't have enough gears or you put it in erg mode and then you go 1 or 2 beats lower or higher, and then suddenly you're in that cycle of death where it just stops all momentum. So is this something that you recommend doing outdoors?
Yeah, I still am old school in terms of that. I like athletes to ride outside. I do understand that, you know, being indoors does have a big benefit. It's noted, there's no question on that. But I just think in terms of your actual environment, outdoors is better. And yeah, typically you'd want to do it on a climb, I suppose, anything from 4 to 7%, just so you have that resistance and it's kind of a more controlled environment.
So when you're doing 4-minute and 10-minute efforts, what are roughly the relative intensities that you would be targeting in terms of?
Yeah, you want to be below threshold. So I suppose you'd be like sort of upper zone 2 into middle of zone 3.
Okay. So upper zone 2 for the 10 minutes and middle of zone 3 for the 4 minutes.
Yeah. So once you kind of have that going, though, also remember, you know, with torque work, you're looking at your newton meters of torque as a metric, where when you have high cadence, you look at watts. So obviously you would do the calculation the same, and you would do, you know, if you're 60 kilos and you're doing 60 newton meters, it's 1 newton meters per kilo. So what I like doing, once you understand the athlete and you get used to them and you know what you're looking at, you would then prescribe newton meters as a goal and a metric for them. So you would say, hey, focus on 0.7 newton meters a kilogram for 10 minutes. And that's what they would hold.
Yeah. And the reference point there, is that just based on, like, how do you get to that reference number? Let's say, is it based on doing a first session where you see roughly where they are and then you're trying to progress that over time? Or is it because you have a lot of experience and a lot of athletes that have done these sessions based on newton meters, so you have that
a little bit of both. I've obviously got quite a big database, luckily, but also I would take an athlete, I would look at what they've done, you know, I would go back on historical data and get a picture and analyze what they've done, where I think they are, and then kind of prescribe off that and give them a range in the first one. So say like, you know, 0.5 to 0.7 and then see where they finish, and then you can track it after that.
Hmm. What do you think in triathlon? Sometimes I see athletes that tend to have naturally a very low cadence, and even things like, you know, your regular threshold intervals, for example, are done at 70 to 75 RPM. Are they less likely to benefit from torque training because they already have a naturally low torque, or is it still because you're still going to higher newton meters? I understand that. So I'm just trying to figure out about who can be a responder to this type of training, or is it really everybody?
Everybody's a responder to it. I have, you know, the only way someone's not a responder if they say, oh, I don't like the session. But I've never had someone that isn't a positive responder on it. And where you got to remember from a triathlete side is, you know, your run is probably your end key factor. So you want to be able to get off the bike as good as possible to run. And how you get off that bike, and also your bike position, but in terms of that, is how you get off the bike is how good your run is going to be. And if you've kind of, you know, saved your legs and run, you know, when you say you're getting fatigued off, if you're doing, say, Ironman and it's 180Ks and fatigue starts kicking in, you automatically, the lower the cadence goes, you always resort back to newton meters of torque to turn those pedals, you know. And if you have those pathways and you have a higher torque value, you're going to get off the bike a lot better than you are than someone that's not going to get off the bike, you know, that's kind of maybe fatigued and lowered the cadence, and now they're starting to grind more as opposed to running a higher cadence.
And if you have somebody, and let's focus on amateur cyclists and triathletes here, you've had them go through a progression over some weeks of the 4 minutes and the 10 minutes. What is the end? What is a reasonable goal for how many intervals of each of these types of sessions, and what are the recoveries between intervals?
Yeah, so typically if I do 4 minutes, I like a 4 minute rest. If they do 10 minutes, I like the 10 minute rest in terms of between each session. In terms of what the progression is, it really depends on that athlete. So to say, they find a 3% or a 2% or a 10% is really hard to say, because each person is individual at the end of the day. But, you know, if you want to see, and it doesn't sound a lot, but if you ask someone to do it, it is a high value, is, you know, if they're on 0.7 newton meters and you finish on 3, it's a really, and you finish on 1 newton meter per kilo, like, it's a really good progression in terms of torque.
And a number of intervals for that you...
Again, depending where they are, if it's the first time they've done it, I like doing 4x4s, but typically the maximum I do, I either do 6 or 8x4s, and then on the 10 minutes, I'd either do 3 or 5x10s.
All right, yeah.
I've seen some guys do like 5x20s and stuff, and I just can't see the quality there till the end. You know, that's me personally. I've never, you know, if I make up a session or something, I try do it myself as a dummy, and I've never done like 5x20s, but I just think that because of that neuromuscular strain, I just can't see there being quality after the third one.
Yeah. So I'll ask you to comment on another type of torque session that I heard about recently. So this was an interview with a Dutch cycling and triathlon coach, Guido Vroomen, and he talked about doing basically 1 minute efforts at pretty much max torque,
yes,
is my understanding, and probably long rests. I can't remember the exact specifics of it, but
yes.
Anyway, what's your thought on, and then he said that he has seen some good success with that type of session. I think he did other types of torque sessions as well, although I don't remember exactly.
Yeah. I do prescribe a 1 minute effort. It's a little bit of a change though. It's like, it's 1 minute and then there's a 30 second on it. And so, yeah, look, he's a fantastic coach. So from that side, I know what he's talking about. But it works as long as you get a response. I just personally like a 4 and a 10.
Yeah.
You know, that's it.
Yeah, that makes sense. Like you find a few things that work, and you can't do every single session that exists.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. What are some factors, and this can be a bit directed to athletes, self-coach athletes in particular, that people should have in consideration for, you know, the factors lead to individualization of training. So, yeah, can you talk about how you see that as a coach, and things that people should be aware of when it comes to how they might maybe need to do different training than their mate?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, good points. Good question there, because it's not like one mold or one system fits everyone. You know, there you look at, I suppose, rider phenotype. You know, are they a diesel? Are they a sprinter? Are they super VO2 max dominant? Another one being, going back to what we spoke about, what is their recovery rate? Do they recover quick? Does it take them longer between key sessions to recover? Training history and an injury profile, I think, is really important in terms of that. Psychological profile, you know, how they respond. I suppose this also goes back to training history and injury profile, but, you know, from a psychological profile, how they respond to different workloads, that's really important. And then another one I think is also really important in terms of training and stuff is what is his or her performance goals, and what is that time distance or that time horizon to that goal? You know, like, do we have 2 weeks to Ironman, or do we have like 6 months to Ironman? You know, very different approach when you do it that way. And then another process is, obviously, I think, which we do pay attention to, but not enough of, is like environmental context. So climate, are they at altitude? Are they snowed under 6 months of the year, et cetera, stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. No, those are all great. And following up on the athlete phenotype there, because I think that's always a fascinating topic to discuss. What are some general guidelines for how you would coach somebody who is more fast switch dominant differently from somebody who's more slow twitch dominant, if you simplify those profiles like that?
Yeah, for me, I won't say I focus one in the other, you know, so as an example, a sprinter is fast naturally, if we take that. So what you want to kind of, for me, I would identify the rider, identify the type of rider, and then I would go back in history and see essentially, yes, he's good at sprinting or he's good at climbing or whatever it is. But for me, I would try find what he's not good at or what needs to improve. So is he does he or he or she have a bad fat oxidization? If so, I'd want to improve that. Yes, you keep working on that rider sprint. But for me, it's not that I only focus on that. I try focus on the areas where there's improvement, where it needs to be improved to make that person better, while making sure that their good part, being their sprint or their climbing, is improving at the same time. But typically, if you improve underneath, everything raises above.
Would you say that that means that you're focusing a bit more on the weaknesses than the strengths? Is that fair?
Yes and no. Like you want to keep the strength strong. There's, you know, that's why that rider is in the position that they're in. Yeah. But you want to make their weaknesses strong at the same time. And they should, you know, as I said, if you build at the bottom, the top will also go up.
Yeah. All right. And current trends in training that you may have seen or heard, do you think, are there some current trends that you would say are overrated and also underrated?
I won't say like things are overrated. I think, you know, there's definitely, because I think everybody has so much free access to science, if we want to call it that. I think that there's more fads going on, like Tade and his cranks were, it blew the world up going with a shorter crank, you know, and then now everything is just heat, you know. So it's like, it kind of, I feel that it, you know, but yet both have a very good place where they need to be. Like shorter cranks for some people are fantastic, for some others it's not. You know, heat training, when you hear about people doing heat training in like December, January, and you're like, well, what are you doing it for? No, it's just to whatever, increase hemoglobin mass. And I'm like, okay, but when are you racing? And they say, no, April or March. You're like, okay, but you know, you're kind of wasting your time here. Or they do it wrong because they don't understand correct protocols and stuff. So, you know, I won't say that something is good or bad, because there's a lot of good. It's just, I think, how we use that and what is used.
Yeah. That's a very good perspective. And yeah. But is there something that you think is, well, on underrated, so something that is maybe not discussed as much as it should be, and that it really is working?
Recovery.
Yeah, that's a really good one.
To be honest with you, if you really ask me one thing, I would say it's recovery. You know, in the endurance world, in normal endurance world, it's like, you know, more is better. And typically when you're doing more, you're recovering less, you know, and that goes back to eventually to the beginning of our talk. And I just feel that is definitely missed.
Yeah, yeah. Are there some common mistakes that you come across? And maybe here we can discuss, especially from the amateur cyclist perspective.
Yeah, I think chasing intensity too often. So too many high intensity sessions in a short period of time. I think that's kind of really a common mistake. I think going too hard on endurance rides is another mistake commonly made. You know, like you often see bunches coming past you like absolutely flat out, or, you know, they just riding too hard on the easy days. I think those are sort of two very important parts. Again, ignoring, I suppose, recovery signs. When you're really feeling flat and dead, like take a day off, you know, let yourself reset. And I suppose kind of inconsistency in training patterns, you know, I think that's also one of the big common mistakes.
With the endurance rides being too hard, and this might be, well, from my perspective, possibly a current overrated trend, zone two, because I think that probably a lot of endurance training, at least when you reach a certain volume, almost has to be zone one to be able to do the quality. So that's what I was going to ask you. Do you also agree with that? And especially when you see athletes chasing the top end of zone two for all of their easy rides or training, and that ends up being putting them in a bit of a hole.
Yeah,
correct. And that, you know, what you got to remember with that, it's like they say, oh, it's only zone two, but it's a high energy consuming zone, you know. So in terms of depletion, it's quick, you know, it does create fatigue. And when you're fatigued, you don't adapt to training load. And when you're fatigued, you can't hit the numbers on the high intensity sessions.
Yeah.
You know, So it's like the snowball of negatives.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I think that the one of the reasons that it's so trendy is that, like, some, you know, big influencer promoting it, like, might have an FTP, if you want to talk in FTP terms, of 150 or 170, and then you're no longer in an really energy consuming zone when you're in zone two, so it might work. And the reality is also that you have a very narrow span of zone one and zone two, so it makes less of a difference. But when you get to 250 or 270 watts, you already have quite a lot more energy consumption going on in zone two. And when you get to 350 or 400 plus, then we're really talking about massive.
Yeah.
But I think even at the amateur level, there comes a point when it becomes more demanding than it's talked about as being, basically.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think, you know, a lot of it is that like the easy days aren't easy. They're medium to hard, and the hard days are hard, you know, and you sit there going like, it's never going to happen for you. You know, you may be good for, you know, you kind of almost hit like a subconscious kind of peak just because of that load and the intensity. But then when you drop off, you typically drop off pretty hard, you know, and then that's when questions are asked and puzzles and then more mistakes and you chase more intensity. And you know, it's just kind of a rabbit hole of despair at the end of the day.
Let me see here. Are there any things that amateur cyclists can learn from how the pros train?
Yeah. Structure, attention to recovery, fueling habits is really a big one. You know, fuel for the ride, no matter whether it's just an endurance ride or it is just it's an intensity session, fuel for it. And kind of when you do, if you're following a program, you know, each session has a purpose. So make sure that you stay within that purpose of the session and kind of often understand that you can't replicate their volume that they do. You know, you can't replicate their time availability and, you know, kind of support systems that they have, you know, whether it's massages, your nutritionist on tap, you know, Sonia, et cetera. So I think if those things are taken into account, I think you can do well as an amateur, and many do.
Mm. And I have a couple of listener questions after this, still in the training section, but the final question from my list here on training is, can you give three key pieces of advice to amateur cyclists and amateur triathletes? And this might be a repeating of things that we've already talked about, but yeah, three key pieces to remember.
Yeah, especially for triathletes, I would say, you know, nail and focus on your endurance. You know, as we said now, you know, that zone two is a weapon if done correctly, definitely. So prioritize your recovery. Again, more is not always better. More effective is better. So quality over quantity. And because of that, and because of the load of what triathlete takes on you, three different disciplines, is always fuel your training. Underfueling definitely limits adaptation and recovery, you know.
Yeah.
I always make a joke with a friend of mine who's a triathlete, and you know, he amateur triathlete, but he does well. And I always say, you know, the guy or girl that rocks up on the finish line less smashed, I mean on the start line less smashed, wins the triathlon, you know, because everyone's just put themselves a bit into a hole, you know. So from that side, I think, you know, I think maybe those three tips would be kind of key from me for a triathlete.
Jim Vance, the triathlon coach, he talks about getting somebody to the start line happy and healthy. I think those are the two, and I think that's you'll perform well if you manage that, especially in something like an Ironman, where the balance is really quite hard of doing the training but not overdoing the training. And then a couple of listener questions on training. Tom asks about training interventions for durability.
Yes. Yeah, a big word in today's cycling, if you want to call it that, or I suppose in endurance sport in itself. You know, what improves durability? If we give two key factors that I use, obviously your volume and endurance, but being, again, going back to that endurance, make sure you're sticking to the right zones or the right power, etc. And another one that I found has a really good component on durability is low cadence work, so your torque work.
And Alexis asks, as a 19-year-old triathlete focusing on middle distance racing, and I think from context here, he's focusing on getting pretty good, let's say so, professional level. But should you have more focus on FTP development or VO2 max?
And sorry, he is 17 years old, is that correct?
19 years old.
19 years old. For him, I would start, it's a good question. I would start, his VO2 should be high anyway because he's young. For him, I would start working on durability, especially if he's looking to go more full-time professional or go into the longer stuff. I would start working on durability, would be first and foremost. And then I would probably work on threshold with him to try raise his threshold, which will essentially make him faster.
So do you end up working more on VO2 max with the pro cyclists and the young developing, the World Tour cyclists, when they get a bit older and you have that start to have that natural decline in VO2 max, is that when you start to bring it in a bit more? Is that as a general rule of thumb for
how? No, you would work on it anyway, because you would try, a little bit, get your threshold as close to your VO2 as possible, so that's your kind of performance metric. So it's not to say that because they get older and it drops, we try to pick it up and work on it. You would work on it anyway.
Yeah. But just, when you have added balance of threshold and VO2, when VO2 max is a limiter, you start to work on that.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
And how do you actually measure that? Do you do that through gas exchange testing or critical power testing or something else? How do you, or what is your metric for seeing that?
You can always do a calculation on VO2 at the end of the day, for 5-minute power, et cetera. But for us, for myself personally, the best way to measure it is obviously in a controlled environment in a laboratory by just doing a standard ramp test, which is your VO2 test.
Yeah. All right. So let's discuss bike fitting a bit.
Yes.
So tell us more about your background in bike fitting.
Yeah, our company, Science of Sport, one of our big projects and our big services is biomechanics. We do a lot of biomechanical research at the same time. And we've developed our own fitment software, which we're using in correlation with another software package. And and with that, we obviously do a lot of education, like biomechanical education, bike fitting education. And that is our history as a company, as a person, etc.
And you have your physical presence is in Girona, is that correct? And do you have other offices as well around the world?
Yes, we have South Africa, which is at the Sports Science Institute, which is the performance testing and biomechanical research department. We run that. We do biomechanics there, obviously, and testing. We have here in Girona, where Daryl Fitzgerald runs and manages that. And then we also have in America with Dr. Wendy Holiday. She's on the East Coast. And then our software itself and our system, we sell that all around the world, essentially.
Yeah.
To individuals.
And how did you get into bike fitting personally? Was that before or after getting into coaching?
A little bit at the same time. I kind of, because of the injury that I had from my motocross bike, the biomechanics was quite complicated. So I took an interest in it then at the same time, just to get things right and comfortable. And then obviously the more we got into it from a company side, obviously I was directly involved with that.
Yeah. And is that something that you still do a lot in or somewhat?
I still do it a lot. I love it. Because everyone is different, whether it's a road bike, a TT bike, a track bike. We started doing quite a bit of track bikes. Yeah, I'm I make sure I'm super involved in it. I like to keep myself up to date on all the latest stuff. So from that side, it's I kind of dropped the ball on other things, but the biomechanics I'm definitely stuck in on.
All right. Yeah. So let's start with if you can walk us through a bit of your typical bike fitting process. What does that entail?
Sure. So yeah, we first do kind of like a rider interview or a client interview in history. So, you know, previous injuries, are there any medical issues? What are their current issues, previous, past? You know, what are they doing? What is their goal? What is their riding style, etc.? Then from there, we do an off-bike assessment, which comes down to, you know, flexibility, leg length, full leg length, lower leg length, discrepancies, if any. We do arm length, we do sit and reach, we do obviously shoe size, foot size, etc. And then from that, we capture the current bike that the person had brought in. We then do the on-bike analysis. So we do motion capture, but we also do static. So we get the two together. So we make sure that both of them are correct in terms of what we see, whether it's motion capture or whether it's from a static value. We also do saddle pressure mapping on that. Whatever we find upon that outcome, you know, it's kind of where we go with that specific client's bike. But obviously then as a final part, you know, from saddle mapping, we do obviously cleat position, we do pedaling mechanics, pedaling motion capture, etc. So it's quite extensive in terms of what we do. And then obviously there is, you know, basic documentation follow-up in terms of what we where we started, where they finished, and why we've done it.
Yeah. If somebody comes in with without any injuries or anything, but just to do get like a first bike fit on yes. a bike and they haven't really fitted it properly, what are some of the most common issues that you see in bike fits in non-injured cyclists and traffic?
Yes. Yeah, often we see is typically the position is too aggressive, so it's not a sustainable position, and that kind of potentially can cause injuries, even if it's just saddle sores. But a lot of the time, a very common thing that we see are saddles that are just way too high, or the front end that has kind of been cut and slammed, or it's just way too aggressive, you know, even if they do have spaces underneath. And then lately, obviously, with the craze of shorter cranks, yeah, we've been getting a lot of that in where, you know, it fits a lot of people, but it also doesn't fit a lot of people. So it's kind of more of an education point and saying to them, you know, hey, you know, Mike Smith, the reason it's not really feeling good is because of X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. And what are the most common, like, injuries related to bike fits that you see people coming in with some kind of issues or ailments?
First and foremost, I would definitely say saddle sores. It's a common, you know, saddle is wrong or position is wrong, etc., and they've got chafing or discomfort. And then I would probably say after that would probably be knee pain. So whether it's patellofemoral pain, etc., whether it's front, back of the knee, you know, maybe just a tendon rubbing on the knee, on a bone. But typically those, I think, are the first go-to points.
Yeah. And are there a couple of key things that you would look into for each of those two? So saddle sores, is it just testing a different saddle or just saddle height and also have to do with it?
Yeah, so we would obviously do pressure mapping on it to try identify where or how. We'd also do the distance of your sit bone, so your sit bone width to see if you are on the right saddle width or not. And then also in terms of just the actual saddle itself, you know, there's so many different saddles in the world at the moment that, you know, people are definitely sometimes not on the right saddle, you know, so it can be something as simple as, oh, we just go 10 mil wider on the saddle, you know, from a 143 to a 155, or it's simply maybe, you know, this saddle shape doesn't work for you and you just put you on another saddle. So, and then it obviously gets a lot more complicated from that. But I would say probably those two parts are a very common point.
And knee pain, are there a couple of common causes of that?
One, cleat position can obviously definitely do it. Weak glutes and hamstrings are a very strong point. You know, we'll also do an assessment like that if we feel that this is where there's a problem to identify that. saddle too high, saddle too low, you know, too low, pain in the front of the knee, saddle too high, pain at the back of the knee. You know, so there are some common, what do you want to say, traits or kind of pointers that lead you in that direction.
Yeah. And yeah, so it sounds already, if you think about the balance of power production and aerodynamics and comfort, you already mentioned that a lot of people maybe go too aggressive. So basically too much focus on aerodynamics is how I interpret that, or what they think might be aerodynamic anyway. So how do you view that balance of those three: comfort, power production, and aerodynamics?
Yeah, so, you know, essentially you want to go, you know, if we take a TT or someone on a triathlon, you want, like, a TT is about going as fast as you can with the least amount of effort, you know. And yes, you want to be aerodynamic. And, you know, example I give is, like, you can't be fast if you can't stay in that position, you know. So you can go to a super aggressive position and you have a CDA of 0.17 and you go do whatever, 90 Ks or 100 Ks, but you can't hold that position. You're not sitting at a 0.17 CDA anymore. You know, you're moving around, it's impossible. So, you know, you need to first have, you know, if you can't hold the position, your aero or your power gains are totally irrelevant and it's out the window. You know, so your power production essentially is linked to joint angles, you know, hip and knee angles. You know, so again, if your hip is too closed, you're limiting your power output. And then if you go to, you know, that's just one point, which also then leads you to get off the bike and run, which has a direct effect on that. So if you've had like a tough bike, you'll automatically typically have a bad run. And then obviously the aerodynamics, you know, small aero gains that cost power or comfort are simply a net loss, you know. So you want to be able to, I would rather have someone at a CDA of 0.19 and can hold 300 watts for 5 hours than someone that starts off with 0.17, ends at 0.21 and they can't do anything, you know.
Absolutely. And yeah, so you mentioned the shorter cranks already. I think that is, as you said, a big trend. Who are the people that it might be good for, and who are the people that it is not good for, if it's possible to group them?
Yeah, it's a good question. Like, so the shorter the crank, the less torque you have, the more neuromuscular strength you need. So, you know, it's harder to actually turn that pedal at a, you know, when you want to produce power. You also got to remember that your cadence will go up for the same amount of power depending on how shorter the crank is. So, you know, who does it benefit? It does benefit a lot of people. You know, if we start off with, you know, from an aerodynamic side, it can help hip angle, you know, even cornering, you can get a better cornering in because the crank is shorter if that's the case. You know, so if you have injuries, you have, yeah, just, you know, if you're a small female and you can't turn a long crank like a 172 or a 170 or a 167.5, sure, going shorter definitely helps. Where it doesn't help is, say, you're on the opposite and you have a leg length of like 100 or 110 and you're 7 foot tall. You know, running a 160 crank is, you know, it's like watching those monkeys in the circus trying to go forward on a bicycle. It just doesn't work. And the neuromuscular strength for them to turn it, you know, and sometimes when you are big like that or just your body doesn't allow it, you have a too open hip angle. So you have no hamstring and glute recruitment. You know, so from that side, it's, you know, for me, I'm all for them, but it's not just, oh, because Mike Smith has done it, I can now do shorter cranks, which is typically what we see.
Are there any other trends in bike fitting, good or bad or indifferent, to comment on?
I don't know if it's a trend, but like a lot of the time you see just a bike fitter just slams the cleats all the way back, you know, without doing it's like, oh, this is what we do, this is best, and they shove it all the way back. I think that's criminal, personally. You know, so yeah, I wouldn't say there's trends or anything. It's more just, I think, some practices that are being done.
What are the consequences of that, potentially?
If you shove it all the way back, as an example, you have a higher saddle height. You know, so is that taken into account? Typically, no, it's not. You also have less explosivity, you know. More hamstring and glute recruitment, great for endurance, but not always, you know, so there are some consequences that come with that.
Yeah. And what is the role of technology in bike fitting? You mentioned motion capture and pressure mapping already, so you're using some tools. Can you ask technology in general?
Yeah, I think the way it's going, obviously, where bike fitting is in terms of software at the moment, I think it's in a really good place. You know, so if you take static with a digital goniometer, you take pedaling analytics, you take pressure mapping, you take motion capture, I think it's in a really good place. You know, where will it be tomorrow? It's a good question. You know, do you get real-time biofeedback during outdoor rides? Do you get AI-informed positional changes or integrated sensors for ongoing fit validation? I actually have no idea, but these, I suppose, are a few things that I can think of.
Yeah, that real-time biofeedback, that reminded me of, I mean, I guess it's not biofeedback, but at least measuring even during outdoor rides. I haven't used it myself, but I have tried it, but very briefly. Leomo, that was something that came around a few years ago. Is that something that you've used or something similar?
I've used it. I don't use it, though, and not for any other reason that I just don't. Or not in common practice, put it that way.
Yeah.
You know, so it's not an everyday thing. If you need it, yes, we use it, but it's not something I incorporate like into an everyday fitment, put it that way.
Yeah. All right. Let me see. Were there any other questions here? Yeah, actually, this is one that I think will be interesting for a lot of athletes. How does an athlete ensure the best possible chance of having a good bike fit? Like, for some athletes, they might not have many options depending on where they live, but if you have a lot of options, you live in a bigger metropolitan area, then you might have multiple options. What are the things you should look for when you're looking for a bike fitter? Of course, unless they can go and see you, in which case they should, but but that's not possible. Yeah.
You know, something I say, and I say it exactly for myself as well, like it applies to myself, is that I think, you know, any tool is only as good as the person using it. You know, so you can have a bike fitter that has all the bells and all the whistles and all the latest stuff, but if he or she genuinely doesn't understand it, it's a bad bike fit. You know, so from that side, you say, like, you know, what do you look at is, you know, I would definitely try seek someone that A, has a good reputation or a positive reputation, and they've done good work. You know, not just to say, oh, I've done all these pros and there's jerseys on the wall, because that's not bike fitting. You know, it's like, as if they've got a good track history, I think that's the first and most important. Because as I said, a toolsman's only as good as the tools they use. And I would definitely say, you know, come with all the information. If you do go to, so say you find that person, be super open and honest. And if you are having problems or what you're feeling, even when they're making changes, you know, definitely say, oh, this feels good. Or if it doesn't, it doesn't feel good. I know sometimes for females, you know, if it's their first time or maybe the second time with a bike fitter, if it's a male, they, you know, kind of do have problems sharing stuff naturally, you know, if there are saddle sore issues or something. So that trust needs to be built. But the more open I think you are with the fitter in the moment is the best thing. Ask questions, take notes, you know, and, you know, kind of come and do a little bit of, you know, make sure that when you get there, if you are on the indoor trainer or on a bike, etc., just get a 5 minutes of pedaling in, you know, just kind of warm up and get comfortable, and then kind of do it from that. In terms of another thing, I suppose, you know, a fit is a process, I believe, not a one-time, once-off, away you go. Well, I say that sometimes it is, but, you know, reassess yourself regularly, because you may make a change as your body adapts. You may need to make another change. The other big thing is don't chase, like, or don't expect to have a pro's position first off. I think that's super, really super important.
Yeah. Great advice. You mentioned the warm-up in the fitting process there. Is that something that makes sense to do also at the end of the session when you have your final position for that session? And because sometimes you have Like, I've certainly coached athletes that have come away from a fit, and during the fit, it all felt great with their new position. But then they get on the bike at home, and after X amount of minutes, it starts to hurt, or it's not very good, at least. Mm-hmm. So is that something that you would look to have at the end of the session, a little bit of continuous pedaling to check, even though you might not be able to do a full workout there, but at least having some continuous pedaling to check that nothing bad happens after 5 or 10 minutes?
Yeah, you can, of course. You know, we kind of, you know, if I just take our experience with the client is, you know, during the whole foot process, they are pedaling. But we do kind of what we say is like, how do you feel now? And we let them ride. It may not be 10 minutes, it may be 5, because we also say to them, you know, hey, this machine said this and that mapping showed this and that, but how do you feel? You know, that to me is really important. You need to ask the person how they feel. You know, it's not for me to say to them, you are good now and you ride away. You know, so that afterwards, yes. But also remember, in a static environment, you'll never mimic riding outdoors, you know. So, but in saying that, it shouldn't be so radically different. Put it that way, you know, maybe, hey, drop the saddle a millimeter or come up a millimeter or nose down on the thing, whatever, super small things. But you shouldn't be doing a complete, like, you know, there shouldn't be radical changes after you leave a bike fit.
Yeah. We're coming up on time, so let's just do one final listener question. And
cool.
For the listeners, follow Scientific Triathlon HQ on Instagram, because that's in the stories where I put up the request for listener questions for interviews. Yeah. So this one is from Gal, who asks, how do you keep yourself informed on, and in general, on different topics as a coach and bike fitter?
Yeah, it's a good question. I'm always seeking information. But in saying that, there are certain people I surround myself with that I trust and I feel are on top of, you know, on that higher end of the scale in terms of whether it's bike fitting, it's coaching, it's whatever it is. And I also constantly seek out information. So I'm trying to always stay on top of stuff. And I'm always asking questions, always speaking to people that I trust. It's a small working group. But in terms of that, I'm always trying to keep on top of what's going on. I do think maybe a bit of my personality doesn't allow me to take on like magic and bullshit, I think. You know, so I kind of sieve the stuff out very quickly. But for me, it's a constant learning every day.
It's mostly people, other people.
Correct. And as I said earlier, we fortunately have a lot of research going on in the company. So it's also easy to go, what are these other 12, 13 people doing? And making sure that I kind of grab info from that. But I typically, if something interests me, I reach out to a person who I think is knowledgeable in that, or I go onto whatever, if it's a website, I go onto that and I read. But for me, I try constantly kind of keep up to date on trends and processes. From the bike fit side, I will say though that the amount of work that we are luckily enough are able to do as cycling has evolved, we've had to change bike fits and progress with that. You know, so from that side, it's kind of a natural process in terms of the biomechanical side. But then like the coaching and stuff like that, I try to keep up to date with everyone else.
Yeah. So finally, where can people follow you and find you and including bike fitting and those sorts of things?
Yeah, website, I suppose the company website is science2sport.com. It's with a 2, I think it is. Yes, no, T-O. Number, yeah,
number,
that's right.
Number 2, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's that. I should never say that.
I'll put it in the show notes.
Yeah, Science to Sport. And then my Instagram and my Twitter or X, whatever you call it, is Pelotrain. So Pelotrain. Although my Instagram isn't always work-related stuff, so don't judge me when you go on there.
No, that's fine. Sounds like you have enough work going on without without also posting about it on Instagram.
Yeah.
This has been great, John. Thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it. And hope you have a great summer with lots of success in the races.
Yeah, thank you for having me. It was an honor. Thank you.
I hope that you enjoyed that interview. Just to comment a bit on the sub-maximal fatigue test that we discussed, first of all, I will link to the interview that I did with Professor Robert Lamberts, who was, I guess, the originator of the test that led to John's submaximal fatigue test, although they used a slightly different protocol. Or so basically, John has developed further onto Professor Lambert's idea. But how, from what I understand it, because I couldn't find the blog post, I haven't been able to ask John yet, but I will see if I can, between recording this and publishing the episode, get a hold of a blog post or a specific documentation to put in the show notes. So far, I haven't been able to find it, but from what I can gather, basically, after an easy spinning warm-up of 5 minutes or so, you do 3 minutes at or slightly above your FTP, and you measure your heart rate, as we discussed, and also you monitor your RPE. So you basically assess your RPE at the end of the 3 minutes. And then at the end of the 3 minutes, you also answer a couple of questions about your mood, how you feel mood-wise, how you slept, and if your weight has changed in any way. There might be one or two other questions that I missed, but in essence, that is what it's like. And the rest of it, how to judge changes in heart rate and RPE for a fixed power, is something that we discussed in the episode. But again, I will see if I can find something more specific to put in the show notes. But if not, I have a detailed interview about the original protocol by Professor Lamberts, an interview about that I will link to. And that is in episode, let me check here, 299 of That Triathlon Show. So I'll link to that and you can go and have a listen to that. And that will give you a really good idea for the protocol that John uses for the submax fatigue test, which I think is a really great idea, by the way, to use that sort of protocol. Either way, you can find the show notes for this episode on scientifictriathlon.com/TTS465. And I will link to all of the relevant links, including that interview with Professor Lamberts. There's also in your podcast app, there is a detailed episode description with some other recommended listening, cycling related in this case. So check that out for if you haven't listened to every single episode of the podcast. That's a good spot where you can find other episodes from the archives that might be interesting for you. Of course, links will be available to John's website, Science to Sport, which is, by the way, not the number 2, it's 2 in the URL, even though the logo and the company name, I believe, is with the number 2. So that was my confusion and why I thought that the website or the URL to the website was also with the number 2, but that is not the case. Anyway, I put the correct URL in the episode description and the show notes so you can find it. Now, if you listened this far, you're probably a very motivated athlete. You're interested in how to improve your performance as much as possible, but you probably also have the normal constraints that most of us have, professional life, family. And one of the best ways to maximize your performance within those constraints is to work with a coach. And I would recommend that you consider working with a scientific triathlon coach if triathlon is your jam, because training for triathlon is complicated and doing it on your own often leads to making mistakes, second-guessing yourself, being too biased towards what you're used to or what you're enjoying, or on the other side, jumping from one thing to the next without enough consistency. So there's a lot of pitfalls that you can fall into. And working with a scientific triathlon coach, you'll have clear guidance, structured plans, and you'll get confidence in your approach. So if you're interested in this and want to see how good you can be within your life constraints, then visit scientifictriathlon.com and check out our coaching page, or email me on michael@scientifictriathlon.com. If coaching is out of your budget, then we also offer customized plans, ready-made training plans, and consultations. So there are different options to suit most people, if not all. And you can find lots of information about each of these options on our website, and also, of course, by emailing me and asking. Always happy to help with that. Now, big thanks to our sponsors, Precision Fuel and Hydration, that you can find on precisionfuelandhydration.com. If you're looking for high-quality, practical, and tasty fueling and hydration products, make sure to try Precision Fuel and Hydration. And don't forget to take 15% off your first order with the code TTS25. Thank you, as always, for listening. Keep training smart and keep loving triathlon.